Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the max level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. When you come to keep an open mind, you will see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. You'll also see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now tonight, my special guest is an award-winning journalist. Her name is Jenny Feit. She's covered crime, politics, government, healthcare, art, and all things human. She's been a spokesperson for a governor, a member of Congress, a few colleges and universities, and a robotics research and development company. She has degrees from Rutgers University and Johns Hopkins University and studied at the School for Women Healers and the Maryland Poetry Therapy Institute. She's completed her first murder mystery, Folly, set in the rolling hills of Jefferson County, West Virginia, and is currently writing another Sam Lagarde mystery, which is the series that Cromwell's Folly is a part of. She currently resides in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia, and so I'd like to welcome Jenny. Jenny, once again, how are you tonight?
I'm good, David. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. And it is Cromwell's Folly, am I correct, the name
it
of the
is.
Book?
Yeah.
Okay. Why don't we start right there and then back up and see how you got to there. What would you like to tell us about the book?
Well, I can tell you about the name. The whole time
okay.
I was writing this book, in my mind it was always Folly. And that was because I had looked up this whole raft of research about delusions and how people operate if they are deluded about something. And, you know, I came upon the folie à deux and trois and quatre, and I discovered that you can have folly way out to the hundreds, at which point it becomes a political movement. So folly was just in my head, and that's what I wrote to. And just about almost every character in the novel, now called Cromwell's Folly, is the victim of some kind of self-made delusion. Certainly, the killers are, the victim is, and from time to time, even the detective is the victim of some delusion or another. So the book got written. Amazingly, my agent, Kano, found a publisher for it immediately. It went into the whole editing cycle. And last August, as I'm trying to get on a plane to go to New York, Jeannie calls and says, no, she texts me and she says, you can't call it Folly. I said, we're down to the very end. I've already done McNally's. We're working on the cover. She said, no, it can't be Folly because I just looked on Amazon and there are four other books called Folly. You can't call your book that. You have to call it something else. Well, fortunately, as fate would have it, my plane didn't board. In fact, it didn't board four times. They kept putting us on the plane and taking us off and putting us on the plane and taking us off, which gave me ample time to correspond with Jeannie about the cover of the book. And finally, she came up with Cromwell's Folly, and I said, okay, that's it. That is what it's called, Cromwell's Folly. I don't know if I'm the cause of the plane not taking off or not, but I got it done.
Well, I think that's fascinating. How did you come up with you researched the meaning of the word folly to mean delusions,
well,
or did you start out with the idea that your characters would have these delusional aspects of self?
It was sort of, the book came at me. It's fairer to say it that way than that I came at the book. I was just driving somewhere, doing some kind of chore, and the book started telling its story to me. I mean, just right into my ear, as if someone were sitting in the seat next to me, talking at me in this voice. I got my chore done. I came home and I started typing like a madwoman. My husband is looking over at me, thinking that I have now completely lost it.
Uh-huh.
And after, I don't know how, like 2 hours went by, I'm typing madly. And then I read to him what I had typed. He said, "Oh my God, keep going." So I had the beginning. And then I sort of had the idea, well, somebody's got to die. I mean, I have this dead guy. He had to die for some reason. Can't just have a dead guy and not have any motivation. So I started thinking about what would make somebody kill someone. And I found it very difficult to do. So I had to keep making my victim nastier and nastier in order to build up the enough nerve to kill him off, basically. So I was trying to think of what would bring, I needed more people than one person to kill him, because if I couldn't imagine doing it myself. So I had to have another person, and then I had another person, then somebody else popped up, and then another person popped up. And so finally I wound up with five. And I thought, there's something else going on here. There has to be some motivational thing that's driving this. And that's when I started investigating this whole idea of shared delusion. So that's sort of the core of the psychology of the killing.
Well, that's fascinating. You know, because we live in a world where people get caught up in delusional realities, and just the whole human experience is fraught with that, and become mass delusions like what happened in Germany during World War II.
Yeah.
You know, it amazes me how we as spiritual beings can get off track when we go down paths of darkness. And so obviously when you're dealing with a mystery, there is a murder and there are paths of darkness. What intrigued you about this particular genre? Had you ever thought before you started channeling the book, if you will, that you would write a murder mystery?
No, I never imagined that. The first novel I ever wrote, which of course is long since torn apart, was the usual semi-autobiographical path that beginning novelists write. The second novel that I wrote, which has not been published but might get published, was a political thriller. I was responding to stuff that was going on in the news that just was driving me crazy. And all of a sudden, these characters showed up and said, "Hey, I'll handle this for you." So that might be pretty close to being ready, but I'm still not. You know, you have to put it out there in front of somebody who's not your family. So you better make sure that you're not embarrassed by it. So
there you go.
Right, that's still sitting in the can. And then Cromwell's Folly came out of nowhere. And after Cromwell's Folly was done, I started working on a different novel entirely, one I'm still working on. But while I was working on that, a second Lagarde story showed up, which is now called No Good Deed Left Undone. Another title, thanks to Jeannie. And actually, No Good Deed has already been taken up by Black Opal Books. So they have that under contract, and that'll come out in 2016.
Uh-huh.
So that's the same kind of thing, another murder. More bad
okay.
people. Or misguided people.
What do you think causes people to become misguided like that? What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, gosh, there's so much that I think I'm just beginning to scratch the surface. Somebody was talking to me the other day about my victim, about Ben Cromwell. She is a social worker. She teaches sociology at Sheppard University. She was telling me that some of her students may be in the next reading that I give at the university because she talked to them about the book in class because Cromwell, as it turns out, is the perfect sociopath. I had no idea that he was the perfect sociopath. I simply described somebody who would drive me insane. And that turns out to be, according to the book, what he is. So maybe we all really know what madness looks like, even if we've never studied it or had a course in it or seen the definition anywhere. But maybe humans always know. You know, it's just like Star Wars. You know what's in the light and you know where the dark side is and you get to choose. Maybe we choose daily. One time we're walking in the light and the next thing you know, we are pulled over to where it is a little bit gloomy.
Well, I believe that life is an unending series of choices that we have to make, and we have free will to choose whatever we want to do. And the challenge for all of us, as I see it, is to make a choice that will not only serve ourselves well, but serve others well, too, that we be kind and compassionate in all we say and do, and think before we act, think before we speak. And, that certainly is a challenge.
I think that's a very enlightened point of view. The notion that you can choose your behavior. I think for most of the characters in my novel, and then the second one, and now and the other one I'm writing now, doesn't look to me like you have a lot of choice. You might have a little window of choice from time to time, but once you set things in motion, you tend to roll downhill pretty quickly.
Mm.
At least in these stories. And that's not to say once you got down at the bottom of the hill, you couldn't get up and say, okay, I'm done with that. But it does look a little predestined.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Well, that's an interesting topic for discussion.
Yes.
What do you think about predestination for some people? Do you believe in fate?
I think I do believe in fate, yes.
Yeah.
The novel I'm writing now has a lot to do with fate. And then, unfortunately, it has an angel who tries to fix that, but most people don't get an angel. So my husband and I used to argue about this all the time. He used to say, it's all genetic. Whatever you're going to do, whatever you're going to decide, however you're going to be, your personality, everything, what diseases you get, it's all genetic. It's all pre-programmed. You are both hardwired and softwired up the kazoo. And you pretty much don't have a say. And for years, I fought him about this. I thought that couldn't possibly be true. At the very least, he had to leave a little room for environment to have an effect on that genetic predisposition. Then I discovered epigenetics, and I went trumpeting around the house, see, here's scientific proof that the environment actually does have an effect on your genetics.
Uh-huh.
And we argued about that. He said, that's pre-programmed also. And I don't really know whether he is right or not. But there's a new show on TV called The Brain, on public television, and last week he pretty much said every decision that you make in your entire life is based on the hardwiring and software in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of, if you've never heard that before or thought that before, that could be quite grim.
Yeah, I would say it is.
Or you could take it as a blessing. It's like, oh, okay, well, what is that step? I've forgotten which step it is on the 12 steps, but, you know, give it up to the higher power. Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Beyond your control is just give it up to your higher power.
Right, right, right. Well, you know, there's some people that would say our souls make a choice when we come into this life as to what lessons there are to be learned and what needs correction. You know, there's the whole notion of karma, which is very interesting. So, you know, I have a lot of people on the show that have discussions along those lines. What are your spiritual beliefs as far as what comes after this life, if any?
You know, I'm grappling with that. My husband died last September, and so I've been through a whole year of thinking about this. He strongly believed that there was a God and that he was going to have an afterlife, and he was pretty sure he was going to heaven because that's just the kind of guy he is. And he was absolutely sure that heaven was this beautiful river where you could just walk out up to your knees and fish all day long and nobody would tell you to come home and do anything. And he had me half convinced about that, to tell you the truth. Although I now think probably everybody's heaven is different.
Mm.
Just made for them.
That's a good question. That's a very good question. I've come to believe in reincarnation, which to me makes spiritual sense from the standpoint that it gives us an opportunity to experience the gamut. And it kind of explains why some people have really difficult lives and other people don't, that we all have the chance to overcome whatever and move on or not. Or
I don't know if we all have the chance. You know?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. But, you know, this is the life we're leading, and that's all that we know for sure. And so, you know, I guess it does come back to choices.
It might have been a guy named Thomas More, but it might have been Scott Peck. I can't remember which one of those two guys. One of them said he was very much interested in what saves a child who is exposed to abuse and poverty and sort of endless travail. Then there are a whole bunch of children you can look at. So of hundreds of children who are suffering in this way, one child will not only survive that, but thrive and make something out of their lives. And so he was really puzzled by this, and he looked at all kinds of things. And finally he decided, and he wrote a book about it, that it comes down to grace. That you are essentially, you know, it's the old Calvinist idea. You are selected. And that selection is what saves you. And that's pretty, you know, there's two ways to feel about that. One is, God, I hope I'm one of those kids. Mm-hmm. And the other is, what about all the other kids? Why wouldn't they be saved? So my problem is, I can look at these things from both sides. So that's sort of stops me from planting my feet in one side or another.
Well, sometimes that helps us figure things out, though, you know, when we examine both sides of the equation.
Maybe it helps me be a novelist, because in novels I get to play out the scenario from both sides. I can have a character that's going one way and another that's going a different way.
Well, where is your novel available, and do you have a website?
I do have a website. It's jimmyfite.com. Pretty easy.
And that's
Jimmy.
Yep.
FITE.com.
Okay.
And I think you can get, I think there's a link to all my books there, but there's certainly one for Cromwell's Folly. And I'm also on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and, you know, Google Play. I think the e-media versions, they're fighting with each other for how little they can charge you for the book. So you can get it for like $3.97 if you have a Nook or a Kindle or something.
Well, let's talk now a little bit about the Grace and Jenny's life, where it all began and the journey that you've been on that's brought you up to this point where you're writing books, since that was something that had not been part of your grand design earlier on. Interested in the twists and turns that your life took that brought you to your today. Would you be willing to take us back in time and tell us about your life?
Sure. How far back do you want to go? I once did a past life regression, so I can go away.
Well, oh, you saw that, huh? That's another show. Well, let's focus on this life for now.
Okay. So, actually, I think that I thought about writing books a long time ago, and then life got in the way. So I think I probably pretty much intended to be a novelist by the time I was 19. But when I was 19, there was college. There was a man in my life. I was still young, you know, I worked. There's all this stuff going on. And what I had time for was poetry. I wrote a lot of poems, some of them pretty awful. But I just kept writing them because they just kept coming. And there was a year when I burned 300 of them. That was a good thing to do. I figured if it was worth it, it would come back. Of the 300, only one came back.
What was so awful about the poems?
They're just not well made. They were melodramatic. They were trite, cliched, badly expressed. The structure was wrong. Just any of a variety of things that can be wrong with a poem.
Okay.
And it didn't stop me from writing. I just got rid of the ones that were sort of weighing me down. So since I kept writing poems, then, let's see, when I was 31 years old, I went to work at Loyola in Baltimore, which then was college, now is a university. And I met the entire English department and was invited to participate in their workshops, even though I was working in the public relations department. And this, you have to know what an extraordinary thing that was, because at that time, and maybe it's still true, academics did not want to be seen with anybody from the public relations department. It was definitely sniffed at as an occupation. But they, for whatever reason, they liked me, and they let me play with them. And when I was 33, they invited me to submit a manuscript for a chapbook, which they then published. And I had no idea. This is how dumb I was. I had no idea what an extraordinary thing that was. I just thought it was really nice of them to do that for me. Totally, I can't believe how naive and thoughtless I was for most of my life. And I'm guessing I'm probably still that way. I just don't see it now. Later, 20 years from now, I'll see it. So I got sucked into the whole world of public relations and politics and blah, 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 all of that stuff. And meanwhile, I had married, I had children. You know, life just kept moving on. So this notion that I wanted to write books was in my head, but not really present for me. Then I went to a seminar. Since I took both the LifeSpring and the ESCH trainings, I can't tell you which seminar it was, You see a pattern here, right? And they asked us to write down 5 life goals in this little notebook. The only life goal that I recall writing down was, I want to have all my novels published and be a famous writer. I had not written a single novel yet. It's like no novels, zero. I had zero. Not even a novel idea at that point. I had started writing short stories, but there were no novels in my drawer. And then life went on, and I started, I find it difficult to not take a course in something. That is probably, now that I've been watching the Brain series, I understand my brain craves data. It's just a data crunching machine. So if I'm not getting the data from my daily influx of newspaper reading or novel reading or poem reading, then I have to go somewhere else and stuff it with something. So I started taking these wonderful courses, and thinking about how to use all the material that I was seeing. I don't know any other way, but and all of this is kind of unconscious. I know this sounds really weird. And when writers tell you that their characters talk to you and they go where the characters tell them, I hate that. But I think that everything that you've ever learned gets stored somewhere in your brain, and your brain, without you paying any attention at all, starts putting things together. It has a little kitchen up there, and it starts making all these soups. And a whole array, a buffet of food is just being created for you. And finally, it directs you to pay attention. Hey, look here. And it's all ready. You just have to open yourself to it. So that's how I got to writing novels, I think. And the other stuff, the classes I took, I know you think they're interesting in themselves, the School for Women Healers and the Poetry Therapy Program.
I do. I can confess. Yeah.
Well, what do you want to know about them? I'll tell you.
Well, I'm interested in how that's changed your, affected your perspective on life, and whether or not there's any fodder for writing as a result of that. But I also am interested in talking about the School for Women Healers, either now or at a later point, because a lot of people that are listening to this program are looking for spiritual notions that they can relate to or mull over in their minds. So I'm going to leave it to you what you want to discuss first.
All right. Well, I went to interview Sheila Barth, who at that time was practicing in Mount Airy, Maryland. And she had a holistic psychotherapy practice. But there was a buzz about her in the community, and I decided to write about her for the newspaper. But she was so intriguing to me that after a 2-hour interview, I asked her, how could I take any classes with her? And she said, well, yes, she had this 2-year School for Women Healers program. I said, okay, sign me up. I really had no idea what exactly we were going to do. And we met once a week for 2 years. Most of the sessions involved learning some healing technique. So there are many, many healing techniques that don't involve the insertion of anything into somebody's body, including a pill. From deep breathing to centering yourself to meditative practices to feeling your connectedness. You know, apparently tonight or tomorrow, whenever the brain thing is on again, he's going to talk about how we are actually all connected. This is an idea that the New Age folks were talking about many, many decades ago. that is now founded in science. We organisms are all part of one whole collective thing. I don't want to call it a hive. It's too big for a hive. But we vibrate based on the people around us. That's why they now say, if somebody is toxic to you, just don't be there with them. You know, don't try to fix them. Just go away. There's just so much. There's 2 years of learning in that program. And I think that it was good for me in a number of ways. It got me to think about health in a different way, which I later used when I worked at Philips Communication. I worked with Susan Mark, Dr. Susan Mark, and Dr. Christiane Northrup, both of whom are brilliant women physicians who almost 20 years ago were moving away from the prescriptive patriarchal, you have to read their books to really get the flavor of that, down medicine that was being dispensed to women, to a sense that women knew what their bodies needed and could ask for that and ask for assistance in getting that for them to be healthy. So I think that the School for Women Healers sort of laid the ground for me to understand what Northrup and Mark were telling me later. But it's all of a piece, you know, all of that whole oriental medicine, the acupuncture. I've also done newspaper stories on those as well. So I think I was headed in that direction. And if there's predestination, I would say that I got a big shove in that direction. And everything that came up about that subject, I just went and devoured the information. And then because I was working in journalism, I was able to put it out into the air again. So it went through me. And maybe that experience of things going through me is also a part of the novel writing, I'm guessing, but it might be, because that's how I experience writing poetry, that the poem moves through me. I don't make the poem happen. The poem happens, and if I'm lucky, I catch it.
Do you feel like you're a channel for what you write?
Yes, yeah, often. Sometimes, well, it depends. If it's really the middle of the night, I feel that very strongly. But if it happens during the day, you know, poems, if you're a poet, poems happen to you at the most inconvenient times. You can be driving down the street and the poem is happening. And you know, if you've done this often enough, if you don't get that first line, at least the first line, it's going to just disappear into the air. You have to get the first line down. Yes, just like. So I would say that's given to you, whether it's given to you by a muse or an angel or somebody speaking to you or your brain, which has prepared this thing for you and is now ready to deliver it. I don't know. I don't know. I can't pick. All of those would be delightful. I'm happy with the way it comes to me, and I certainly don't want to jinx it.
I don't blame you. I don't blame you. Can you talk about the Poetry Therapy Institute and what that did for you?
Right. So poetry therapy, again, I went to interview the woman who was she was probably the president of the Poetry Therapy Association that year, and she also was offering a course. And it might be a function of that I get enthusiastic about things. So I talked to her for several hours and wrote about her. And then I thought, well, I want to take this course. So for 2 years, I took that course. And I learned some very interesting techniques that I did use later. For several years, I created this program called Writer-Sizing, which is kind of like Jazzercise, but for your brain. And there's just this extraordinary thing that happens to people. If you read good poetry or good fiction to them, when they're all sitting there, and then you ask them to write, their brains do extraordinary things. I can't describe how it happens, but it happens to every single person who's in touch with that great art. And maybe it's the same thing that has art schools send students over to major museums to copy the masters. So this is with words. So you read the masters. And you don't discuss it. You're not taking the poem apart. You're not trying to understand how it happened or what it means or any of that. You just, Robert Olin Butler says this the best, you are just thrumming to it. And then you write. And the stuff you write under the influence of this other stuff is brilliant. And so you're rewarded. And your own creativity gets returned to you, particularly if it's been stifled by people saying to you, well, what is that? Sky is never green. Or the other various things they say to you when you're little.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that for about 5 years. So one day I thought, gee, I'm really bored. I think I've done this enough. I moved on.
What did you move on to after that, Jenny?
What was I doing? Well, I think I was still doing newspapering, but at that point I started writing short stories. So I have a book of short stories that's about karma, called What Goes Around. And there's quite a few stories in there in which, well, let me put it this way. I really believe that there is karma. But I probably only believe in it as a little thing extracted from a larger system of belief.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you're lucky, karma comes back on you really fast so that you learn really quickly. You don't have to wait until the next lifetime when you come back as a beetle, when you were previously a human. If you're really lucky, something happens immediately. And you know that the thing you did wasn't a great idea. But karma sort of matches up really nicely with the whole golden mean and do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You know that you get back from the universe what you put in. And
I believe that. In fact, I have said before that I believe that if we only followed the golden rule, we wouldn't need the Ten Commandments. All we need to do is do unto others as we'd have them do unto us and be loving. But a lot of us don't even know how to be loving to ourselves, let alone to others, and that's the conundrum.
Yeah, I think that's the danger with the do unto others. If you are battered early in life, that's what you know, and that's what you're likely to do. Hence, all those other rules you have to follow. Not that you
right.
follow them. Yeah.
Right, right. Well, they certainly don't in murder mysteries, do they?
No. In my murder mystery, at least this first one, some of them get away with it. What one of the reviewers said, you don't know whether to root for the detective or the killer. So, I think I've made it ambiguous enough.
That sounds very intriguing that way. What's your writing discipline like?
I write every day.
Do you?
And
I
do that in the morning. Because in the morning, if I'm lucky, I wake up with this whole to-do list. So this morning I woke up with the red scarf. I know this sounds completely crazy, but anybody who is a writer out there knows what I'm talking about. The red scarf, it's missing. It's missing from the bag. I have to say that. I can't just know it. The reader has to know it. And then so there was this whole sort of list of things that I needed to go back in to the novel and address. Every time I think I'm done with the novel, I discover I am not done, which is an old poem by John Donne. if you think you have done, you are not done, or something like that. That is
how much rewriting is involved for you.
Oh, well, I did read a quote today that made me feel better. Ernest Hemingway said that he rewrote, or he didn't say rewrote, he wrote the last page of Farewell to Arms 39 times before he was satisfied with it. And that actually made me feel better because I've been worried that I was too obsessive. But it is possible that I will have written every page of the novel I'm working on 39 times. It's possible. And it's not because I'm a crazy perfectionist. It's because things keep occurring. And if something occurs downstream in the novel, I have to go back and make sure that there's an antecedent for it, something that says, watch for this flag, particularly in murder mysteries. You have to sort of plot them pretty carefully,
mm-hmm.
or they won't make any sense at all. And I do like to keep the reader a lot of balls in the air. One of the women in my writer's group said that I like to have a three-ring circus in which there are clowns, acrobats, and people leaping through hoops that are on fire in every ring. And that might be true. I might be doing that to readers. Makes it fast to read.
Well, what kind of suggestion would you offer to somebody that wants to write, that has had that yen but has never really put pen to paper? What suggestions would you have to them?
Read. The first thing to do is to read everything you can get your hands on. It almost doesn't matter what you read. Comic books, horrible novels, romance novels, mystery novels, great novels. It doesn't matter because everything gets put together in a particular way. And if you read enough, you'll begin to see that, you know, comic books have a particular structure. Dialogue happens in a particular way. Some of the storytelling is in those little square boxes, and some of the storytelling is in those round boxes with arrows that go to the mouths of the characters. That's as good a start on what the structure of a novel is going to be like as anything else. But then read everything. Read all the classics that you can. I mean, the libraries have everything you need. You don't have to buy a single book. Just read as much as you can. Cram everything in your brain. And then write. Those are the only two requirements. And it doesn't matter what you write. Just fill up a page. It doesn't matter. Just keep filling up pages. Eventually, the story is going to show up, or the poem, or the essay, or whatever it is. It's going to show up. And it's okay to throw stuff away. So, you know, I mean, if Hemingway had to write it 39 times, that's just one page. Imagine how much he threw away, right? So don't be afraid to throw stuff away. You can burn 300 poems. It will be okay. And don't take yourself too seriously. I guess that's four rules. Read, write, throw stuff away, and don't take yourself too seriously.
I think that last one is very important, especially when it comes to just living your life every day, because so many of us do take ourselves way too seriously. And and then we miss the joy along the way. You know, it's amazing how many people don't stay present to the moment and don't follow a pathway to joy. And I think for some people, they've never discovered their true life purposes. And that's sad to me. It took me a long time to recognize what I wanted to do with my life. What would you say to somebody that doesn't have a sense of purpose? What suggestions would you make to them?
I think actually everybody has a purpose. They just haven't sat still long enough to hear it. Or they don't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
I do like the idea of tranquility. The mirror writer, you're alone a lot more than most people can bear, frankly. But being alone with just your brain yammering away at you does give you time to let whatever's important be heard. You know, turn off the TV, turn off the radio, turn off the CD player or the Pandora or whatever. I don't know how anybody can write with noise on, to tell you the truth. There's so much noise in my head, and it has to be true for everyone. I can't be the only one.
Mm.
We all have voices, and something will clarify. You just have to give it the space. Everybody has a purpose. I know, I went to a training where they said, no, but there's no such thing as a purpose, but that's baloney. I think we invent our purposes. It's certainly true that artists invent the most difficult purposes. If you want to pick something difficult to do, be an artist. Be a writer.
Mm, I agree.
Nobody imposes a purpose on you. If you're an artist, nobody says, make me a bridge, or build me a robot, or organize this event. There's no outside instruction coming at you. You have to create your purpose for yourself every day. So from that, I'm pretty sure that we can do that. You can make a purpose for yourself. Maybe the purpose is only I'm going to clean 4 toilets today if you happen to have a house with 4 toilets.
God help.
I'm going to make my bed.
Right.
I'm going to cook a meal. Those are all purposes. They're not tasks.
Go ahead.
People don't take any joy in the things they do. You know, so you could actually be a brilliant bread maker, but if you only think of it as a chore and not take any joy out of the actual making of the bread, then you miss out on the whole thing. That's another thing that artists teach you.
That's an amazing and profound point, I think, because there are so many things that we just take for granted as we go through life, or we view them as chores and tasks, or just things that we need to get through to get to the next chore or task. And that does rob us of our joy. It seems to me that it's all a matter of the attitude that we take. What would you say about that?
I think you're right about that. The problem with the word attitude is it sounds like something you could change. You could change your attitude. I'm not sure you can change your attitude. I think you can change the way you're being. But that, if I say it that way, that's all those years of training coming back, all that spiritual healing stuff. So I think you can fundamentally change the way you're being. And that will alter everything, your perception of everything and the way you are about it. I know people, my husband said, people can't change. Nobody changes. The world says that. People don't change. I think people don't change because you tell them to. People don't change on cue. But every 7 years, every cell in our body is different from the way it was 7 years before. Every cell in our body changes. It has got to mean that we can change. It's not a fluke. We can change. We do change. I'm willing to bet that I'm changing right now.
Well, we change just from our interactions with each other, and I think that's why it's so important to pick and choose the people that we interact with. Earlier you talked about the idea of staying away from people with toxic energy. We can focus on what we need to do for ourselves and not get involved with trying to fix somebody else, because they're only going to resent that and probably rebel against whatever we tell them to do. We seem to think that we can fix the world, and the only thing that we can truly fix is ourselves. And I was just going to say, as far as attitude goes, I find that the attitude of gratitude goes a long way, and that when I can focus on grateful for, it brings me back to that place of joy where my life begins to have meaning again. What would you say about that?
I think gratitude is very important. But gratitude feels like a really big word to me. I prefer to think about it as I'm grateful for this.
Mm-hmm.
So it is an act on my part. It becomes a verb rather than a noun.
I like that.
It's not a thing I name. It's a thing I do.
That's some food for thought for me.
Okay.
Well, they say that actions speak louder than words.
Yeah,
so that makes sense.
That's true.
Yeah. What else would you like to say to new writers, to writers that have a book, have been beating their head against the pavement, trying to find a publisher or an agent? What encouraging words or words of wisdom would you have for people like that?
Okay, so find a local group of people who are like you. That's number one, because they will encourage and support you in all of your trials and tribulations. The hardest part about the book is not writing it. The hardest part about it is finding an agent who will like it and a publisher who will print it. And I know I can't fix that problem, but at least if you have a group of people who are trying to do the same thing that you're doing, you have some support. So when you come back and you say, well, that's my 57th agent who said she wasn't interested, somebody can be there to commiserate with you. But you really have to be persistent. There's no substitute for it. You can call it whatever you want: determination, persistence, stubbornness. I've been called all of those. Persistent is the nice way to say stubborn. But you just have to keep at it. You just have to keep going. Make your work as good as you can. And then start reading up about agents. And there are indie presses also to take work without an agent. And you can find everybody online. Do your research. Learn about who you're sending off your baby to. I mean, really, would you just give your baby away to anybody? You wouldn't. So find out who these people are. Research them down to the last semicolon. And see what it is they want. Maybe what you're writing isn't a fit for them, but maybe you can find someone who is absolutely perfect for what you're doing. And there are hundreds, there are probably thousands of agents out there. And they're all online, and they all tell you exactly what they want you to do. And each one of them is different. Some just want a cover letter. And by cover letter, they mean three paragraphs. And they better be the right three paragraphs. And if you want to know what those are, you can find that online also. Some of them want the cover letter plus 10 pages in the body of the email. No attachments, please. Some want your entire manuscript. Some want the cover letter, the synopsis, the blurb, and the entire manuscript. And you just have to be ready for whatever configuration it is that they want. And I'll tell you something, I find writing the blurb and the synopsis harder than anything else. It's like for the blurb, you need to like get up to a 30,000-foot view and look down at the work and see what is it about, you know, in 200 words or less. So you've written 80,000 words, and now you're going to find the 200 words that are absolutely perfect to say what it's about. The synopsis is one page, single-spaced, telling the entire story. Oh, my God. It took me 250 pages to write the story, and now I have to put it in one page. If I had known I could do that, I would have just done that. So, you have to do your research, and you have to be persistent.
How challenging was it for you to find an agent?
Well, this was sort of one of those little miracle things. I finished Cromwell's Folly in June, and I decided of June of 2014, and that was, I wrote it, I workshopped it, I rewrote it, I edited it, and I thought I would wait until the day before my birthday, because I decided that would be the most auspicious day. I mean, where I got that from, I have no idea. And in my writing group was another writer who had an agent, and I thought, well, I'll just try that. That's the old tried and true method. Use somebody's name. So I asked for her permission to write to her agent. She said, sure, go ahead. She sent me a link to the website. She said, make sure you follow all her rules. I read that. I read that website like the Bible. And when I did all the things that she asked for, I sent it off. That was Jean. And then my husband died, like 3-4 weeks later.
Oh, my.
And so I completely, it just like, I was like, oh, didn't even happen, really. And then sort of I came out of my, my whatever that is, that state of trauma in late October. And I thought, oh, I haven't heard anything from her. So I sent Jeannie an email saying, sent you my manuscript, blah, blah, blah. She sent me back an email saying, I haven't gotten to it yet. You can withdraw it if you want. I'm like, oh, God, I can't bear it. I can't bear to withdraw it. So I wrote back and I said, no, I'm just checking. Please go ahead. You know, you're in the slush pile. You don't know what's going to happen.
But right.
3 days later, she sends me an email, and she says, oh, my God, I want it. And I think I know who to send it to. I'm like,
wow,
that's amazing. So then she sent me a contract and blah, blah, blah. We were off. And by January, the end of January, I had a contract from the publisher. So it's never going to be that easy again, I think. That was the universe saying, it's okay, honey. Just breathe. It's going to be okay.
It's wonderful when the universe cooperates like that, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Huh. I was very grateful for that, you can be sure.
Well, Jeannie, thank you so much for talking to me tonight. It's been a joy.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you.
How many Sam Lagarde mysteries do you think you have on you?
I think there are 3. So I've written 2 of them, and I know in general who the murderer is in the 3rd one. And I know why she's killing people. And she's not your standard killer. You would never think of her as a killer. I do know that I tend to like women as killers.
Another show.
Yes.
Well, thanks again, and best wishes to you in all of your writing endeavors.
So much.
Much success to you.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. So once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique experience, the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who can and will have a spiritual experience if we allow it to be. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize, And join me every Sunday, Monday, Thursday, and Friday night. And tomorrow night, there's a special edition show with Athena Starr, who will be doing free readings, and it's her birthday, so feel free to call in. Have a great night, and God bless.